Okay, so now we find you in Israel. You're married. Did you serve in the army?
I served in the army, but I'll get to that later, because I served in the army after I came back from Madison.
Oh.
So it was not between 68 and 75. Okay. It was after 83.
Okay. So we'll move on now to when and how you met George Mossa. And were you affiliated with the Hebrew University in those years at all? So it wasn't through the university that you met George.
No.
Okay.
So, as I said, at this stage, I was being the Goebbels of Israel and operating in various institutions, teaching at student kind of organizations, youth group leaders, and so on, making a reasonable living, but not part of the university. In fact, the thought of becoming an academic or a researcher was the last thing on my mind. I always read. I was always interested. But I had not found anyone who influenced me or who I admired or who could be a model at all. Then I think it was in 1968 at a friend's house, Ze'ev Mankiewicz, who was a close friend of mine and who's not at all well, was appointed as George's assistant when George came to Jerusalem to teach in 1968. So one Friday night, he invited me and he said, "We've got this overseas professor, he's a nice guy, come and meet him." So, obviously I went, and at that stage they all, the student revolutions were on, and we said to him, "But Professor Mossa, how do you deal with this? The campus is on fire, it's kind of mad, what's going on there?" And he said, "Oh no, I teach at 10 in the morning. No student revolution begins before 2 in the afternoon." So when he said that, I said, okay, this is a guy for me. This is somebody that I can appreciate. That he was funny, he was warm, he was hilarious, he was kind of non-pretentious. And so I decided, I think he told me what courses he was giving. So I said, go and sit and listen to this guy and see what he has to say. So he's teaching a course on, I think it was the next day or two, a course on anti-Semitism. And he walks into the class, and there's this group of Israelis, and he starts by saying, "You all, you all look like Aryans." This is how he begins. So of course you know what he means. I mean, he's right. He's talking about stereotypes, and he's talking about the fact that Israelis want to become these kind of blue-eyed, blonde, muscular soldier types. So immediately I saw, hey, this is a guy that I can appreciate, that also talks at a certain level that I like. So over the years, between 1968 and 75, I saw him when he came to Israel all the time, and we invited him. Well, I wasn't married until 73, but even after that, we had him over to the house, and we became quite friendly. I'm not sure when I started calling him George. I think until then it was Professor Mossa, especially coming from a South African background. And then at one point he said to me, Stephen, when are you going to stop being a Boy Scout and becoming serious? Why don't you come and study with me in Madison? Now, the reason I would never have thought of doing a PhD in Jerusalem is because at that stage you had to do it in Hebrew. To this day, I can lecture in Hebrew. I can't write in Hebrew. It's unthinkable. I had no idea what Madison was, where Madison was, and nor did George explain to me that by going to Madison in the mid-70s, you're going to sub-Siberian weather. And I'm from South Africa and Israel, where the sun shines.
He left that
and
out.
Where Israel, he left that out. So basically, I came to Madison for one reason only, and that was for George. Since then, as you know, and we can develop this, George became the formative influence in my life intellectually, in career terms, in friendship terms, and as I said to you, in a certain way, as my second father. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those, that's 1968 evening, with the student revolutions, became a very important part of my life. In fact, I've held two academic jobs, one in Portland and one in Jerusalem, both through George. Mm. He got me the job in Jerusalem, he got me the job in at Reed College. So,
but yeah. That is not unusual, Steve, I think, in the sense that he did that for a lot of his students, sometimes successfully, sometimes not as successfully, but it was a different time, of course. That's harder to do now,
yes,
as yeah. we all know.
Yes.
But I'm sure that he put a lot of effort into getting you these positions. I can imagine, especially the one at the Hebrew University, because that could not have been easy.
No, absolutely.
We don't need to go into the reasons.
Yeah. Did he ever speak to you about it?
A bit.
What did he say? You know more than me.
Well, he said it was tough, you know, and because, of course, that is maybe more for par for the course in Israel than it is here, in the sense that professors often try to get their students positions at the universities. But he was not a member of the faculty in the sense that he was a permanent visiting professor or something who taught only in English. But, you know, George was well connected and he was brilliant, as you know, and he was charismatic and he had some allies. I know Ariely was supportive, and so yes, it worked.
Right, that worked. So yes, in many ways, obviously, so he's influenced my life basically, and of course, when I was here, the cultural history course that he gave was stunning. Although I must say, Hannah, my wife, came to listen. And sometimes I had the feeling that he was talking just to Hannah and me, because there were times that we were rolling on the floor with hilarity of what he was saying, and a lot of these people from Wisconsin, I'm not sure if they had the slightest idea what he was saying, especially when he talked about Wisconsin farm kids, or as you, the peasants. And they couldn't have been thrilled. But for us, there was, I mean, to Hannah still, it's worth it, you know, she learned about art, which is her field, through George.
It's extraordinary.
So George, in many ways, you hear when I talk and I speak about George, I speak as George. Mm-hmm. I have his accent.
Yes.
We've internalized George. So I spoke about a model.
Yes.
George became a model. Not just for me. I mean, I think the three of us, the most important, at least of my generation, was Paul, Andy, and me. Mm-hmm. I wasn't with the Seymour and David Sabin. Mm-hmm. And so...
And there was even a generation before that, but we won't go into
whom
that.
I didn't know, but, and I'm sure that the same thing applied. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, he was a model, but... The teaching that I do doesn't only come from George. A huge amount does. But the other comes from teaching in Habonim, which had to be existential, which had to be relevant, which had to be alive. Because you had to motivate kids. Mm-hmm. So it was the kind of combination of Habonim and then George that kind of influenced the way in which I teach. In that sense... both of those influences are at work, but I don't know how to exaggerate George's role in my life. And you said something very moving in your description when you say here, it's later, I'm skipping now. So you and your wife Hannah and your children, your home became the place in Israel that George felt most at home. In many ways, the center of his intellectual and emotional life there. That's a wonderful thing to say.
That's true. I think it's,
So I, you know, I do know that George was as neurotic as I am, and so if he would be invited for 7 o'clock.
I can attest to that.
At 7 o'clock, at 6:30, we would look down, and there was George pacing around, waiting to come up. And I would say, George, you can come up now. Yes, and Gidi Shimoni, another person from Habonim, he once wrote, "We in Jerusalem measure time according to before, during, or after George's visit." Mm-hmm. So the impact he made on a huge amount of people, even if it was for a short time,
in Israel,
was great.
Yes.
Some of the academics were completely shocked and appalled by him, because I remember one of them speaking, I think it was in 1969 or 70, George was talking about masturbation in his class. You can't do that. So and they were absolutely appalled. But of course, these were the things that attracted students, that he talked about these things. So almost everybody who came into contact with him either formed a relationship with him or was deeply influenced. And of course, the fact that we didn't know George was gay, but the fact that he was unmarried and didn't have family meant that he had time and even a need to be with his students, with whom they had developed friendships.
There wasn't that distance.
Not at all. Yeah.
That German milieu at the Hebrew University would have kept with between the and still is somewhat present, I would assume.
Yeah, but I think it's true here too, by the way. Mm-hmm. When I was in Madison, there were no other professors who sat outside of the Union by the lake and had this big circle of people, and George would hold court with them. I don't remember that being true in Madison either.
Interesting.
And so obviously he wasn't from Jerusalem, so these were the friendships he formed. And so that distance, as you say, didn't apply, which made it even more attractive. And then, of course, he befriended my whole family. My wife, who's an Israeli, although she was born in Germany, she came when she was 1.5. And when we came to Madison, he'd always spoken English to her. But when we were coming to Madison, he said to me, "Oh, Steve, how is Hannah going to manage? She only speaks German." And I said, "George, she doesn't know a word of German. She always speaks English."
Do you mean he was speaking German to her?
I don't know. That was George. And then he came, and we became close in a way that I never quite understood. We never discussed our relationship.
Mm-hmm. There
wasn't a need to.
No, you knew.
Yeah, yes. And I liked that. And what are we going to say? I'll tell you about his towards his death. Mm-hmm. But when we were in Madison, and we had Diony, our boy, was born in Madison. Two stories that at Eagle Heights, where we lived, George would often come. And we had is it recording?
Yes.
We had a little, do you call it pram?
Mm-hmm.
Little pram. Mm-hmm. And Yoni was in there, and George would say, "Oh, I really want to get in the pram and have Steve wheel me." Who else would say a thing? That was lovely. And then my son had his Brit Milah, his circumcision. And we said to George, "You're going to be his godfather." And George came along, and we have to hand Yoni to him. Or he says, no, no, I can't hold him, I'll drop him. So George never really held Yoni at the Brit. So and over that time, we were very close, but still he was my PhD advisor.
Indeed, yeah.
And there were certain things that he said at the beginning. I said, I don't really know German. He said, well, it's a technical thing, go and learn it. And so he was tough in certain things. Mm-hmm. But it just deepened and deepened without us ever talking about it. So let me just say two things. I'll skip to his death. As you know, I came here a week before he died, or two mm-hmm. weeks. I think it was a week, actually.
It was more like a matter of days.
Matter of days.
Amazing.
And we spent the whole weekend talking about everything in the world, but not about his illness.
Right.
Not about our relationship. Just talking wonderfully. He just said two things about his being ill. He said, oh, I thought I could go on forever. That was the only thing. And then he said the most moving thing he's ever said to me, which was, I said, George, we've been talking a long time. You must be exhausted. And he said, Stephen, I can never, ever be tired talking to you. So that moved me deeply.
Yes, yes.
And then he went. Mm-hmm. So, and then there's the famous story which you've got to tell about his getting the honorary doctorate.
Yes.
Which that's your story, that's yes. not my story. So it yeah. did deepen considerably, and we all loved him for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And he was a kind of a presence.
Well, and he knew that he was loved. I think that's yeah. the important thing. Yeah. He understood that. I think yeah. it was a great need for him, that kind of nourishment and interaction in a way that, as you said, is unique and is, for me, such an essential part of education, to have that bond of affection and concern. I think that's... And obviously, given the success of his students, it makes a difference. You know?
Yeah,
it makes
a
huge difference yeah. to have that personal yeah. connection. So essentially, your graduate work was all done at UW.
I did the MA at London.
Oh, you actually, okay.
No, it was a one-year thing.
Oh, that's
I got
right.
it done
okay.
in 1 year.
And so you came into UW...
With a master's.
Okay. And were yeah. accepted to work on your doctorate.
Okay. Right. I don't know. I didn't have to. I would have failed all of those tests that you've got to do with math
yes.
and logic.
Yes.
I never had to do them.
Oh,
it was probably
great.
Also through George,
yes.
who then yeah. got me a subsidy for my. But I became a TA in the second year, taught
yes.
at the ILS. Mm-hmm. But for the first year, he got me a special grant from some. Senator at the Capitol. So I got 1 year free tuition, and there was some senator who gave some money or some congressman there.
Well, that's interesting because from what Seymour Drescher has and others have told me, George often funded things and said that it came from other... But,
no,
but
he sent me the first week to go and thank the guy.
Oh, really? Okay.
I wandered around for about 2 hours knocking on doors and he was never around, so I left a note and that was it. But he wouldn't have given me a name of somebody.
Yes.
Without, I don't remember
well,
the name.
Yes, okay.
I doubt
never
it.
Mind, yeah.
No, so he didn't fund
okay.
me.
Okay, yeah.
And the rest of the time I had a TA ship.
TA ship, so...
Yeah, and taught at... not a TA, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a TA. I got a teaching job at the ILS, where I gave courses on my own.
Yes, wow. That's unusual for a graduate student. I mean, that is...
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not in those days, but now it would be...
Last week, this has nothing to do with the thing, last week I get a note from Christopher Hamlin, who taught with me at ILS in 1976, and we're meeting this Friday, the day after tomorrow, in New York.
Really?
So those from those same days. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. That's amazing. Okay, so you're in Madison, you're beginning work on your thesis.
Well,
so
first you've got to go, let me tell the following story.
Okay.
First you've got to do prelims. Is that what it was called?
Yes,
prelims.
Right.
So it was 2 years, and I took with Harvey Goldberg, I took with Sterling Fishman, I took with George Mosser, and I took with Theodor Hammerer in German history.
Mm-hmm.
And I took the prelims, and I did extremely well in 3 out of 4, but I failed German history. Why did I fail German history? I learned later that all of George's students who did German history with Theodor Hammerow failed in their prelims. I mean, give me a break. That was it. That was Theodor Hammerow.
Talk about passive aggressive.
So, of course, if you pass through, you can go on.
Yes, right.
So there obviously was some deep issue between the two.
Well,
I was jealous. I don't know what it was.
Well, it could be that subject of your first year thesis.
Oh, it could be.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yes, there never was. I think there were political differences, departmental differences, the whole approach, different styles of history, whatever.
Right. Although, you know, when my book came out, the first book, The Brothers and Strangers, he had a long critical review of it in commentary. It was a good review. It was critical and good.
But he once wrote a critique of George's career.
Well, that's interesting.
Well, I will send it to you. It was quite laudatory, actually.
Really?
Yes. So that's what I mean by passive aggressive. He would flunk the students. He would sometimes throw these roadblocks in George's path, and could be rude. On the other hand, he was also, you know, quite laudatory if he wanted to.
It's interesting, but that's a fact. I can tell you, and I really didn't fail that exam.
I can imagine you didn't.
So anyway.
So you're in Madison, and you've spoken a bit about your teachers here and what you did, you know, in terms of your early coursework. So,
let me just say about the teachers. First of all, I came, remember, much older. Mm-hmm. Then I was really kind of a retarded guy. I started the PhD at 33.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, my age group was not that far removed from my teachers. And because I had children, I was married, even though I lived in what I think it was Hammerow called genteel poverty in Eagle Heights, in a very, very small apartment, I became friends with my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So two people, I became very close to Sterling Fishman, who was very close to George.
Yes.
And very close to Klaus Bergholm. And for both of us, it was a very meaningful encounter, because here was the first non-Jewish German that I became a friend to, and I was the first Jew with whom Klaus could really become friends. And we became friends first through violent encounters on the tennis courts, which then blossomed into a real friendship. So, although I was also quite close to many people at Eagle Heights, and still am with some of them, it was also because I was older that I became friendly not just with George, but with some of my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I was ever mentioned in print was when Stanley Payne quoted a paper I'd written, a seminar paper for him, in his book on fascism. And the paper was called The Metapolitics of Nazism, and he put it in his book.
Mm.
So these things were also meaningful.
And helpful to you.
And very helpful, very complimentary. And he reminded me of it yesterday. So yes, very positive, completely different to the English experience.
So you, in some ways, you became part of George's circle here in Madison. And actually, by the time you had arrived in Madison, George had somewhat withdrawn because he was spending more time in Israel. And, you know, my feeling is that after the intensity of the 60s in Madison and in George's really intense engagement, both politically in Madison and as a kind of figure, both supporting the students and oppositional, and also his immersion in university committees and overseeing a huge number of doctorates within 10 years, I mean, extraordinary number, that his new engagement with Israel meant that in Madison he became less and less engaged in a way, both intellectually and in terms of other parts of his life. I mean, the first time he had gone to Israel was 1951, I believe. So he was part of that group, Sholem, you know, he knew those Robert Belch, all those people before he met you. But so he had a long history there, but I think that this engagement in the late 60s changed his relationship here in Madison. But you had this circle, he had this circle, and you in some ways became part of his circle that he had developed
right.
over many years. That's
right.
I see the difference between your experience, because you were a little older, and that of many of the other beginning students here.
Yeah, I think I was considerably older.
Okay.
I was 33 yeah. when I started, and 38 when I finished.
Oh, okay.
So I was, you know, I was just the backward kid. I think George had, it was very inclusive. Also, the other people with him we were, he always included them. I remember going to his party, he sometimes had parties.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first time I met Jeff Herf. And he would say, oh, he's into engineering and the Nazis. And he would include everyone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So I'm not...
Oh, yes, he was...
I don't know if I was a particularly... I mean, he you know, he because we came from Israel, I suppose he
yes.
looked after us. But Stevie Rann was also here.
Mm-hmm.
But he left.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't finish,
mm-hmm.
I think.
That's right. It was, I think, a regret of George's that he didn't finish.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so how did you choose your dissertation topic? Was this something that you came up with, or...?
My first choice was Hannah Arendt.
Oh, okay.
Which George didn't want me to do.
Really?
Not at all. And
did he give you a reason?
He said, yeah, it's not a great... He didn't really give a reason. It's not a great topic.
Because that would have been quite a...
Then he reluctantly agreed. Okay. Then I started doing research, and two things stopped me from doing it. Somebody, I've forgotten who it was, had written the kind of thesis that I wanted to write, so it had been okay. done. He never published it. That's why I can't remember the name.
Hmm.
The second was Mary McCarthy held the Arendt papers at the Library of Congress, and I wrote to her, would I have access? Quick as a flash came the reply, no. So that was out.
Mm. Okay.
And then I had to come up with another topic, and George said, oh, why don't you write about the ghetto? No, that didn't have flesh. But I thought, that sounds interesting. And then it worked out to be what it was, which is the Brothers and Strangers book,
mm-hmm.
which is about the ghetto, but about images of the ghetto. It was also very much in the Mossian kind of tradition,
mm-hmm.
But which I think I expanded. It wasn't just the negative thing, it was also the positive thing, and the relationship of Jew and non-Jews. So it worked out very nicely, and I think there was another option. Before I started the PhD, there were two things. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I was still under the influence of some of these Zionist propagandists. And I was thinking of doing my PhD in education. And I said to George, should I do it in education? He said, no, what's education? Don't be silly. Okay. Then I went to visit, on George's recommendation, Uri Tal, who was then in Philadelphia. And Uri Tal said, do your PhD on Theodor Fritsch, who was a leading anti-Semite at this magazine called Der Hammer. And I went to George and said, should I do it on Fritsch? He said, no, 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 you must do something bigger. You must do something more significant. And that's how I got into the top. And he was dead right. Had I just done it on one figure, it would have been minor. And the Brothers and Strangers had some resonance. That's the history. How are you bringing things back that I haven't dreamed about for years?
So, you knew something of George's work in those years. I mean, the trajectory of his career, starting out in constitutional, you know, English constitutional history, and then ending up in German Jewish history and Jewish history. In those years, he was really moving into what became the anthropological turn.
I don't understand what you mean by that.
Well, some people call it the cultural term, but essentially you could say it's influenced by a certain German-Jewish scholarship that preceded George. It is really very much a part of that tradition, influenced by Jung, but it's really aesthetics of politics, but also symbolism, using these kind of underlying tropes or archetypes to explain political behavior, mass behavior, that sort of thing. And it ended up in, you know,
right,
the nationalization of the masses.
Well, it started even with the Crisis book.
First
of all, I didn't know. I mean, I only learned very gradually about the English history, the constitutional history, the kind of history that puts me totally to sleep. In fact, George writes somewhere about somebody who said to him, oh, George, you're such an interesting person. Why do you write such boring history? Now, I would say that's true for English constitutional history. But there's another story, too. I didn't know that he had done this theological work. So at that stage, being a naive guy, I was very much under the impression that that stage of Emil Fackenheim's Jewish theology. And I was starting to speak to him, and I was sprouting away on this. And I said to him, oh, George, you know a lot about history. You don't know anything about theology. So he didn't say anything. It's just that the next day on his desk were those books that he'd written on theology. So then I swallowed hard. So I didn't really know much about his prior work. What I knew, I don't know what year the Crisis book came out.
64.
Okay, so when I met him, I read the Crisis book.
Okay.
So for me, I mean, later I wrote about George, but that was much later, about the trajectory. It was then that I learned about his English history, the theology, the Reformation he'd written on. But for me, the George was the Crisis on. And that still is the George for me, which is not to denigrate his other. I know the Reformation book or the Culture book, one of them is with Königsberger, still sells today.
So Europe in the 16th century.
Europe in the 16th century.
That was another aspect of his work.
Right, for which I cannot speak, because that was not my George. George, for me, is everything he wrote post-crisis of German ideology. But let me make one thing clear, and I tried to make it clear in an article I wrote. People talk about the cultural turn. When they speak about the cultural turn now, they don't mean what George did. They mean the deconstructionist moment, the linguistic turn.
Yes,
George was not that at all. But he was about introducing, as you say, symbolism, the irrational, the masses, all of these things, but it, not the cultural turn in the sense
in the
that
way
people
that it's,
talk about.
Yes, exactly.
And that's important, because he wasn't like that.
Although I think in some ways he influenced that. We don't have to...
I don't know.
In terms of the study of literature and in popular literature, not method so
not
much,
method.
But he opened up certain approaches to cultural history that... I think resonated. I mean, most of that came, of course, out of the French school and Foucault and others. But I
George
think
George said, "I don't like wobbles.
Yeah, that's.
Right. I don't like fruit that is soft.
Right.
And these guys are soft and wobbly.
Yes.
So there's a real difference.
There's a very.
I think there's
a difference. Oh, indeed.
He may have influenced them, but I think. George did, and that's why I think it's important to stress that the Peter Gays and the Walter Lacurs and the Georges are not the same kind of thing as what happened later.
Oh, indeed. Completely different. And I know George was resistant and somewhat appalled by some of the direction. I remember once he said that all evil emanates from the English departments, which I'm sure had something to do with this turn. But okay, so we have some idea of how you came to your topic, and I think you were probably one of the first students that worked on a specifically Jewish, I mean, maybe one of the first students that went specifically into Jewish history, because that was also happening at this time, that he taught his first course in 71 on Jewish, and specifically Jewish history. And he also was embracing his Jewish identity in the 60s in a way that he hadn't before then. It was a kind of transformational period for him. Part of it evidenced in his embrace of Israel, but also the Zionism that he developed, because he did always say that he was a Zionist, of course. He was a Zionist of a particular kind, but so you came at a very rich time for him intellectually, culturally, just, you know, in terms of his work. It was a very, very productive time.
Mm-hmm. What was he doing at that? He was doing other, you know, I mean, it was always, the crisis book, or the masses book, or the sex book, or the death book. All of these things were happening at the time. But I did do Jewish history, but you must remember that when I went to the history department at the Hebrew University, which divides between Jewish history and general history, I went to general history.
That's
very
right.
Glad that I did so, because if I approached Jewish history, it was from the outside in,
exactly.
Not from the in out. Which is to this day true, and I was told that for my second book, it must not be Jewish history.
Oh, okay.
So that's when I did the book on Nietzsche reception in Germany. Mm-hmm. It had to be non-Jewish. Mm-hmm. I had some Jewish things in there, but it's about 5% of the book. So that was important, and I've always stressed, I don't want to say I'm just a Jewish historian. I'd like to say, you know, I'm in German and Jewish cultural and intellectual history, which is basically what George did.
It is very much similar to his. Okay, so shall we move on to your post-Madison career? Are we ready? Is there anything else you want to say?
Where are we now?
You had studied at UW, and you know.
What was George like in the classroom?
Yes, we didn't really talk about him, and also as a dissertation advisor. We can
separate things. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I think that's a good idea.
Well, George in the classroom was George everywhere in the classroom, right?
Yes.
George, you could hear George. There's no question. There was no mumbling, and there was booming when George was there. And of course, that was part of his technique, that he would come out and it would be all powerful. And his technique, I mean, apart from being also, he was funny, he was outrageous. The difference between him and Harvey Goldberg is important, because I went to Harvey Goldberg's thing. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Goldberg, there'd be lots and lots of people, and what it'll be like at a political meeting where you all come out with the same opinion and ready to riot in the streets. Mm-hmm. And with George, George would provoke you and make you angry. So he'd make you think, and there was a clear difference between them, and I went for the George. I wasn't mm-hmm. going to go out into the streets. So I didn't really learn anything from Harvey, to tell you the truth.
He was more of an entertainer, in a yeah. sense.
But so was George.
Yes,
George was always entertaining. Yeah. But there was a point.
Yes.
And of
yes.
course, the, one of his techniques, which I've never done, was repeating. Mm. You know. He always came out and did this. Always, 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 always. I mean, that's how
right.
he talked.
Right. Yeah.
And, of course, he had something which I couldn't have, which was a kind of natural authority. So in Jerusalem, when he was teaching, you have in Jerusalem probably the biggest percentage of Besserwissers that there are in the world. Besserwissers people know better than you. So he's teaching a class on Weimar. And guy stands up and says, no, it wasn't like that. I was there. And George's answer was, as a teacher, oh, you're in the valley, I'm on the mountain. Now, I could never say that, but he could say that.
I bet you could.
So as a teacher, he was magnetic, he was funny, he was provocative, he was powerful.
He also demanded your attention. He didn't appreciate it if you didn't give him your attention or didn't take what he was doing deadly seriously. So there was this entertainment part of it, but it also was a very, very important, serious matter that he was discussing, and he didn't expect you to be there reading a paper.
But it never happened with me. I was always with him.
But I mean, in terms of the classroom, he controlled it.
Yeah,
he controlled it. Very. I recall that, and being somewhat intimidated when I first went to his classroom because of that. You know, that he was aware of the students, and he expected you to give him your full attention, that this was a serious matter. You know, I recall that very, very vividly. And he did train the classes. You know, he trained them because he would snap at them if he felt that there wasn't the level of engagement that he wanted or discipline. You know, he had that kind of German sense of discipline about this subject, you know. He really didn't know.
I never experienced that because I was attentive and I was interested. I didn't have to.
Yeah,
and I don't even remember him doing that to the class, because the class seemed to me to be listening, although I think a hell of a lot they didn't understand.
Well, you'd be surprised. People, you know, it may take some time, but I recall being, I didn't know anything about the subject when some, you know, I'd taken some courses, but it was amazing how much you could absorb from his classes at a very high level of
When did you hear him first?
I think it was 71 or 72, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you were still here in Madison?
No. I came in 75.
Oh, you came, that was even before you.
You've heard him before me.
Yeah.
I heard him in Jerusalem at that time.
Yeah. He, I recall, had a brace on his neck. He was having some terrible...
In 71?
Yes, he was kind of spinal issues, and, you know, he sometimes didn't seem in the best of moods, let us say. He had some structural issues in those years that he overcame somehow.
Because in 1978...
Yeah.
He had that same brace.
Really?
But he was in... Remember, we were talking yesterday about this drug?
Yes.
It was quite clear that he couldn't really go on. And I took him home, and I helped him out.
You mean he in front of the classroom...
I walked up to him and said, George, I think we should stop now.
Really?
Yeah.
And because he was on a medicine because of the pain.
Couldn't go on.
Yeah, I think he... he had some medical challenges in the course of his life that, you know, he overcame.
Mm-hmm. Prussian will, yes. Iron will.
You know, he once said to me, he said, "Oh, my arm, my arm hurts here." And I said, "But what is that?" He said, "Well, I've had this since I was a teenager. I've always been aching and in pain, you know." And I thought, gee, you know,
this is the Prussian side. Yeah,
I would have, you know, not survived such a level of, you know.
And it happened once, and I took him out. And
oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
Don't remember the year. It was 76, 77, 78. I don't remember. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
So it's about 11:30. Do you want to continue? Okay.
Unless you don't want
to. No, I just wanted to check in with you to make sure that...
What is the right time?
It's, well, my time is 11:30 here.
So is mine slow or is yours...
Well,
I can tell you. Hang on. Before we go on. Steve Asheim is correct. 11:26.
Okay, yes. Okay, so I'm at 11:27. Okay.
I think we're going to finish. We don't know.
Well, all right. Well, you know, we can always decide if we'd like to... do a little bit more in the fall. We'll see. Okay, so...
In the fall? Oh.
When I'm visiting Israel, but...
I said I think of myself as a New Yorker then. You know, yeah, will I be in Jerusalem?
Yeah. You'll be back, Steve.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so what were you... You were in Madison. You were one of actually George's final students that he accepted. There were only a couple more after him.
Little Berkowitz.
Yes, and there were some at the Hebrew University. There was Judy Donnerstein.
Donnerstein. I don't know where she is.
She passed away at a fairly young age, I think in her early 50s or something, mid-50s. Yes, it was rather sad. And then, Ari Carmon, who is currently the head of the Israel Democracy Project, was he a...
Switch that off, and I'll tell you the story. I won't tell it off.
Okay, we're back. But yes, there were some students at the Hebrew University that got their PhDs under George's direction. I don't have the list with me, but there were some. And of course, he had a major impact there just in terms of his public persona, but also with specific undergraduates and graduate students that were studying there that he influenced through his teaching that have gone on to positions in the Israeli government and culture and really in the U.S., Europe, and in Israel. So there was a major impact outside the classroom even, because I know he was often on the radio, he had that wide circle of friends there.
He had his friend Scott...
Oh, yes, I remember. Elder.
Scott Elder, who worked for the radio.
Right.
And with whom George was quite close. Yes. And with some other people. So, yes, absolutely.
Scott and Rivka, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost contact with them.
Me too.
But, and I think they're probably retired now, but...
I don't know.
Yes.
I saw him a few years ago, and the only topic we have in common is George.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, maybe should we move on now to... Do you want to say any more about George as a dissertation advisor in terms of... He just basically usually just said, you know...
Well, once we agreed on the ghetto...
Yes.
Then he said, just go. When we were together a great deal, but we never talked about the dissertation.
Really?
Then I gave him chapter one. He looked at it. Read it, made one or two very, very minor suggestions, mm-hmm. and then I gave him the whole thing, and that was it. There was never much... It was clear that he liked it. He was not at my dissertation defense. He was in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And for my dissertation defense was on a Sunday morning, and Stanley Payne was chairing it, and he forgot about it. So they had to wake him up or round him up specially, and he ran in short pants. And there was Sterling, Klaus, Stanley, and this man, who the only one who was critical and asked me good questions from education, not Fran Schrag.
Herbst?
Not Herbst. Herb. Herb.
Not Jürgen Herbst, not Kassel, not...
Herb.
Gosh, I
forgotten his name, Herb somebody. Mm. He asked critical questions. It was over in an hour, and they said congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all took me out for a lovely dinner, and off I went to Reed College.
Mm-hmm.
So that as dissertation advisor, but you know, what else is he supposed to do? You mm-hmm. do a dissertation, you've got to do it on your own.
Right.
You can't right. be fed.
Mm-hmm. I think some students don't understand that and rather resent it when they're professors. Especially now when, you know, universities are much more service-oriented, you know, that the students expect, you know, we're paying this money, so therefore we should get all of this attention. I do think that's changed somewhat, but anyways, we won't go into
that. But it's difficult. I mean, if you're doing a dissertation, you really have, you know much more than any advisor will know.
Right.
It's working.
Yes, we just want to. Okay, so you are now, you have your degree, you have, you're starting your family, and you said George helped you get this position at Reed College. So tell me about that. You
Reed College?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I'll tell you one thing about Portland, Oregon. Apart from it being beautiful,
yes.
It's got the best bookstore in the world, Powell's Bookstore, which is one of the great things I liked about Portland. I did not enjoy Portland, Reed College. My wife loved it, painted there and loved it, didn't want to leave. For me, Reed College was, and the students were good, but it was a petty place. I remember offices were next to each other, and faculty members were very busy writing negative letters about the colleagues in the next door office. It was like Peyton Place.
Mm.
It was not for me. And then they learned that I was writing this book, or it had come out, Brothers and Strangers, 1982.
Mm-hmm.
No, it came out in 1982, so I was writing or finishing it in Reed. And the word went out, Asheim is trying to go national by writing a book. Writing a book means you are not teaching properly. So I felt, you know, well, what the hell am I doing here? It's just too small.
Mm-hmm.
It's too provincial. Mm-hmm. And they don't encourage you to write. Mm-hmm. So my experience there was not a great one, although I gave a lot of lectures to the Jewish community. And I had the best student I've probably ever had in my life was a farm boy from Iowa, whose name, non-Jewish, Jason Weeks, who wrote a paper on Martin Buber that blew my mind, and I thought he is bent for greater things. Never ever heard from him or of him again.
Mm.
So there were some light. I made some friends, but I'm very glad I didn't stay there.
Doesn't sound like a good fit. So you were there for how long?
2 years.
2 years, okay. And then how did this position in Jerusalem come about? I know we spoke a bit about George helping with that, but...
Well, George knew that I had lived in Israel. He knew that at some stage I wanted to go back. I came to Madison and told George, you know, I'm not really happy in Reed.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, well, we'll see, maybe we can get you something. The next thing I knew, he said, we'll get you a job. I've got you a job in Jerusalem. And he'd spoken to Arieli, and at that stage, just two or three guys got together and give you an appointment. Now, there's a real question. Because now, at the Hebrew University, there must be at least four committees that you go through. Which one is the better system, I can't tell you, because it's on one level, it's very corrupt. You know, Masa speaks to Arieli and they say, oh, let's bring Asheim, and that's it. On the other hand, I don't think the quality of the old system is worse than the quality of the present system, because the present system has a leveling kind of effect.
It does.
So, whereas I couldn't possibly say anymore, let's bring back the old system. But it worked for many people. So, basically, yes, George got me the job with the support of Arieli and maybe one or two other people, which was deeply resented. So when I came to Israel, the word was amongst colleagues, it took at least 2-3 years for me to break through the ice. I was clearly the outsider. I came together with two other people, Gabby Motzkin from outside and Robert Wistrich. And the word was, they have been parachuted in. These are alien invaders brought in by people of power who've got nothing to do with us. So it took some time for me to break through and to be accepted. I remember the day, and I become friendly with this particular guy. About 2 months after being there, I get him in the mail, a book arrives, and I open it up. And there is Brothers and Strangers, which I've never seen. It's my first book. Deeply exciting. Wonderful. So he's in my office. I show it to him. He says, that's nice. And he walks out. It was so deflating. So I had a lot of that to negotiate. And then the question is, who's inside and who's outside? Most of the people that I thought were deeply inside, and I was way on the outside, I got my full professorship before they did. So the whole question of who's in, who's out, is a very fluid and subjective thing. And that I learned. In one way, I'm still deeply outside because Hebrew is not my métier. It's not my language. So I'm schizophrenic. I teach in Hebrew. I research in German, and I write in English. That's the way it's been. So that's more
and
or less...
you've survived and flourished in a challenging situation. But it, so who was in the department when you arrived? Was Talmon still there?
No, Talmon was gone, but Arieli was there. All right. And who was a fantastically decent man. And a man George very much admired. He dedicated... God, what is the book called? It's a book of essays. Not Nationalism...
Masses and Men?
No.
Okay.
Something of
Nationalism, the one that he did with... it doesn't matter, I guess.
Yeah, I forgot. Why have I
but
forgotten?
I remember that.
Yeah.
I did, yeah.
And so Arieli was the person for me. And over the years, he really encouraged me, and he was extremely positive. Then there was Michael Head, who just passed away.
Yes.
Who was very nice to me. And I was friendly at that stage with Gabby Motzkin. We came in together. And then there were some absolutely autistic people, half crazed. I won't mention names. Totally unencouraging. Some people who one day you would be talking to and have a lovely conversation, the next day they wouldn't look at you. So that's
typical.
But that's the academic.
It really is.
The autistic kind. But gradually I integrated to the degree that, as you know, I made very close friends with people not in my department.
Right.
With the late Jonathan Frankel, who was a wonderful man, and as you heard from my fest, with Ezra Mendelssohn, with whom I became extremely close.
Okay. This is John Tortorici. I am in Jerusalem. And it is November 28th, 2014. I'm here to interview Professor Stephen Asheim.
professor emeritus of history at the Hebrew University, and George Mossy doctorate. So we'll get started. So Steve, where were you born and when?
Oh boy.
Going back to day one.
If we are talking about when I was born, we have to go into dinosauric history. I was born in Johannesburg in South Africa in 1942, which seems so long away, but that's it. That's the answer to your question. Don't publicize it.
So when did your family arrive in South Africa?
Yeah, well, the first thing to be said is that all this is very obscure and vague. My parents, who were German Jewish refugees, didn't speak much about this, in fact almost not at all, and I, being stupid, never pushed them for an answer. So what I will tell you is approximation. I think that my father came sometime in 1936. My mother came a few months, maybe a year earlier. Her parents, my mother's parents, left Germany, I think, in 34, and left my mother, as far as I know, to finish high school with a non-Jewish family in Nazi Germany. Now, this is not proved. It's something that kind of wafted to us, and I think it's probably true. Then my mother joined them when she finished school, and I think came early in 35, maybe. My father had still not arrived. He had gone from Germany to England, was not granted permanent status there, and then took a boat to what he thought was jungle-laden South Africa. He had been in touch with my mother's parents to rent an apartment, because my father came virtually penniless, and German Jews organized a kind of self-help community. And so my father was going to live in my grandparents' home in a single room with a curtain dividing him from the other guy. At any rate, the apocryphal story is that when he arrived in 1936, my mother, who was 17 years younger than my father, that means she was 17 and my father was 34. The apocryphal story is they arrived. They went to the station to collect my father, and my father got off the train, looked at my mother and said, "Doris, let's get married." And they got married very quickly after. Now, how true any of these stories are, I don't know, but that's the mythical background to my family.
So, your father came here penniless.
He didn't come here. He would never have dreamed of
to South Africa, penniless. And yet, you grew up in a very well-off family. How did this happen?
I grew up in opulence, you could say. Mm-hmm. And half of my life has been a revolt against that opulence. How does that? That's one of those typical immigration stories, especially of middle class Jews. My father started off selling eggs from door to door. Met this fellow from Zurich, Mr. Wheel. They decided they're going to go into the dress business, and I think this was in about 1943. Remember, South Africa's untouched by war. Mm-hmm. It was a time of booming industrialization and economic expansion. They came at the right time and built it up into a massive dress, stockings, and dare I say, brassiere factory. So by the time I appeared, when I was born, I think we were still very modestly well off. But over the years, we lived exceedingly well. And part of the reason was of my joining the socialist youth movements had to do with some kind of discomfort mm-hmm. with it. Now I deeply regret that stupid attitude. It would be wonderful to have money, but that's the way it was.
So, did you live in a Jewish enclave? Did you live where? When did you decide to get involved with Zionism?
Well, first of all, you are not that you're not Jewish. That's not mm-hmm. relevant, but you are American.
Right.
So you will have almost no idea about the structure of South African white society. First of all, South African society anyway was organized racially and ethnically. Black, white, blacks, coloreds, blacks, Indians, whites. Even amongst the whites, identity was ethnically or religiously oriented. So you had English-speaking non-Jews, Afrikaners, and Jews. And nary shall the twain meet. I don't think I ever saw a non-Jew in my house, apart from our black servants, but they weren't really people, you see, boy and girl. And so your whole social life, your whole sense of identity was enclosed within your particular ethnic community. And so I don't recall one intermarriage in our community. Now, that's changed drastically. But at that stage, that's how things were organized. So when the time for my revolution came, it was through the Zionist youth movement, which defined itself antithetically, but was as ethnically exclusive and bound as everything else was. So there wasn't even a question of departure. The only people who really departed from this, and I was too scared to do this, were the people who joined the underground of the anti-apartheid movement, where blacks, whites, Christians, Jews, all mixed.
But was that a little later, Steve? I mean, that was in after apartheid came in, what, in the late 40s?
Yeah,
early 50s?
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. No, I'm talking about, I mean, when I was born in 1942, mm-hmm. so the mm-hmm. time I came to consciousness was in 1959-60. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And during mm-hmm. the 60s, we did know people who okay. joined the underground and then who kind of disaffected from the community. Mm-hmm. Ours was an affected, disaffected attitude. So mm-hmm. it was a kind of I would call it pseudo-revolution, because we really stayed within the bounds.
So this racialism, which really permeated South African society, I mean, you could say it was British or Dutch, but it was an imposition on the system that was already there, but just permeated all aspects of life. Were you at all in relation with the black community besides, well, I assume as servants would be the...
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. first of all, you were brought up by black people. And the black people, it's very interesting, they were domestic servants. And the word applies to them, they were domesticated. Mm-hmm. So they were part of the family, but of course they knew and you knew what their real status was. And there was a great deal of affection there, and I think mutual kind of liking. But clearly, the division was at their quarters. They were called servants' quarters. First of all, they couldn't really go home because of the pass laws. Once every 3-4 months, they could go home. Their rooms, which were adjacent to our house, just in the backyard, were terrible. Cold water, primitive as hell, and there wasn't a sense of outrage. In the same place, the vast differences. So I used to enact, and from the early age I saw, this is absolutely wrong, But from an early, but I was also a good Jewish bourgeois son. And my relation to my parents was an extremely good one. So my ideological revolt sometimes we used to discuss, but never threatening the family fabric. But my revolution was going into the kitchen and singing African songs, sometimes Kosi Sikalele, which became the freedom song of the ANC and then the national hymn. That became my outlet. But all this is pseudo. This is Mel Brooks, you know. Main source of transportation is fear. That characterizes me. So I cannot claim that in any way I was involved with serious anti-apartheid activity, but it was clear from the beginning that something was dreadfully wrong, including the total self-indulgence of the white community. You would never wash your own dish. You would never do your own bed. You would take for granted being served. So,
but you never spoke to your parents about this contradiction that they came from persecution, racialist persecution, to a place where racialism was embedded so distinctly.
Yeah.
This was not something that they talked about. It
well, like. First of all, I mean, let me preface the, I will get directly to the answer, but I must preface it by saying, as I told you, there was much too little history, much too little I knew about my parents. The fact that they were German Jewish refugees came up maybe very occasionally and in oblique terms. They never referred to themselves as survivors. They never referred to themselves even as refugees. There was none of that. So when you say they themselves were products of racial oppression, first of all, that was never really represented to me. That's not their self-representation. But equally, I've actually written about this. It seems to me that given the fact that they were refugees and that, for instance, England wouldn't take them, their main response was not indignation about racism, but gratitude that South Africa took them in and gave them a chance to succeed fantastically. So that, and then of course they are good bourgeois people, and you have to be loyal to those who are granting you these rights. So that was not really an issue. And yet, from the time I was vaguely conscious, I internalized the Holocaust. I don't know why or where it came from, but I was intensely aware of that. And that does have to do with my feeling about apartheid and racism, and it has to do acutely with the way in which I believe we are conducting ourselves here. So if my parents didn't have that consciousness, I have it, and I'm no refugee or survivor. I don't know if that answers you. But
yes.
Anyway.
So where did you learn about the Holocaust? From your parents, or was it in the Jewish community? Or because we'll get to your schooling, but it sounds like your schooling was more...
No, schooling had nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. It's a good question. I mean, it takes place at different levels. The first level is the subliminal level, which is that if you're a Jew in South Africa, you mustn't have America in mind. It's very different. If you're a Jew in South Africa, you are a conspicuous and very, very self-conscious minority. You know you are Jewish, and so you don't want to stick out too much. So I always had this consciousness of difference. And I suppose it's through my parents' accent and occasionally understanding they came from Germany, a movie here, a movie there, that I began to understand what was going on. But I'm talking here at a very, very young age. It wasn't a theoretical matter. It was something you kind of imbibed. And that's why I'm still a Mel Brooks Jew. Fear as a mode of transportation. So, yes, I can't tell you. It was never systematic or theoretical. It kind of entered into me, and I cannot tell you why, because my parents did not dwell on it at all. They sometimes spoke about Germany with contempt and say, oh, those bloody Germans or something, but that's it.
But so there wasn't a sense that this in some ways reflected on what was happening in South Africa.
For whom?
For you as a child. I mean, did you make the connection of this this imposed system of racial categorization in South Africa as you started
from the Holocaust?
When you started to learn about it, and did you see that it had? Because it seems like what you did was move more towards the Zionist Youth Organization.
Mm-hmm.
As your response to this?
I didn't connect the Holocaust then mm-hmm. to apartheid. I did realize that apartheid was shockingly oppressive,
mm-hmm.
But the strength of my Jewishness was probably too strong to make any immediate kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask me now, that's a different thing. We're talking about when I was, I don't know, 9 years and more. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different thing.
Mm-hmm.
I never did make that
that
connection at that stage. No.
So you went to a rather strict boys' school from what you were telling me the other night. So tell me about this school. It was...
I may break out into a rash.
It sounds like an absolutely dreadful
South place. African education at that stage, there were only boys' schools or girls' schools. There's no mixing. Was deeply authoritarian, was disciplinarian, never taught me a thing. I mean, they must have taught me how to read and write. But never taught me anything. And basically, if the teacher would ask a question and I would put up my hand and say, sir, I think, the teacher would say, don't think. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not exactly your ideal institution. And I don't think I'm going to go over this again. You've heard it too often. It doesn't have to be. The fact that I was given cuts and caned and a great deal of... of anti-Semitism, clear anti-Semitism. Yes, absolutely. I think you've heard these stories. I don't want to tell you more. You don't need it for this, do you?
All right. Well, you know.
Do you need those stories?
They're wonderful stories in showing what it was like to experience that kind of education. But I understand that. You know, maybe one story.
For instance, all right. Well, first of all, Mr. Yule, who was my chemistry teacher. And I can tell you now that in mathematics and in chemistry and physics, I was not a star pupil, as you will understand. But for some reason, every time there was a non-chemistry discussion, Mr. Yule would turn to me. And in his enlightened way, Mr. Yule said, Aschheim, I said, yes, sir. Do you know why World War II was fought? And I said, no, sir. He said, I'll tell you, Aschheim. World War II was fought because of you people. So I said, sir, and you couldn't argue with these guys, sir, I can't really tell you why that's not correct, but I do not think that's correct. And he sent me to the headmaster for caning. So you get some idea of what kind of things went on there.
It explains to me, anyway, why you ended up in this room. Because, you know, I think that kind of experience makes a Jewish homeland all that more attractive.
Yes, I agree. I'm glad you're taking the Zionist side here. But another very important reason for getting here, and it's also difficult for an American to understand, that the experience, and George would know this, I mean, the experience of the youth movement. Mm-hmm. All my closest friends still are here, and we are still all together.
Zionist,
camaraderie, yeah. Yes. And ecstasy. It was a kind of mad ecstasy, mm-hmm. of singing, of laughing, of sex, of meaning, ideas, uh-huh. ideology. I have intellectually outgrown it, but I haven't emotionally mm-hmm. outgrown it.
Uh-huh. It's very attractive.
And now I'm very, very critical of it, you know, and in many ways it was so ecstatically enclosed that one had pure contempt for anything else outside. So if anything brought me here, what you say is correct, is no question, but the steam, mm-hmm. the lubricant was that, and I think that still applies. Mm-hmm. And George understood that.
Mm-hmm. He did.
I think he really got yeah. that. Yeah. And when he showed me how similar to the German folkish movement this was, that opened my eyes.
This group that you met in the Zionist youth organization, Habonim.
I prefer you to call it Habonim, even now the word Zionist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said that this was one of the most meaningful things in your life.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And that you're still dear friends with this group. And it's really an extraordinary group, the ones that I've met here in Israel and in America. But I'm struck by how close you all are and how you relate still on such a intimate way, you know, that you're funny with each other, you're supportive. It's really, I can see how that would
be. By the way, I don't know if we want this recorded, but yeah. You know, Zev Mankiewicz is in hospice. He's dying.
I'm sorry.
I don't know if you knew him at all.
You did, indeed. He and his wife gave me, when I first came to Israel, gave me a tour.
What year was this?
Well, it wasn't the first time I came to Israel, actually. It would have been right after George died, which would have been 99.
Ah, okay, yeah. So that's not Jean, that's Bella.
Bella, okay. Yes. Okay. She's okay. The 99.
Okay. Yeah, no, no, that's all true, but I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, I think it was more to enhance what you said about the power of this attachment, this association, and how it's carried through your entire life.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that isn't so common for men in particular to have lifelong group of friends like that. You all, it sounds like most of you stayed here in Israel, even though you...
Are in the States or in Canada or in Australia, mm-hmm. but there is a group here that mm-hmm. did remain, and many, you know, they've done well, including one you met who's now vice head of the Fed in America, Stan Fisher, who is way and above everyone else, there's no question.
But still
But it's not the accomplishment. You have, you know, it's one of those things you have to be in, so it would be silly. It works almost totally, and that's why I was so attracted, amongst other things, to George on humor.
Mm-hmm.
On absolute, you know, mm-hmm. kind of mad humor. And that's how we do it. I think that's mm-hmm. a big thing. And apart from comedy, I'm sure you have common experiences with friends that you had, associations, all mm-hmm. those other things. Mm-hmm. But it's also being foreigners here,
mm-hmm.
which keeps us together. Mm-hmm. English is all our main, it's our lingua franca. Mm-hmm. So there are all kinds of things. But, I mean, the reason I took to George immediately. I didn't know his academic work. It was his hilarity that got me.
Great person.
And then it developed into other things. But that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. Shall I tell you the first story when we met? At Zev Mankiewicz's house. I think we've talked about this. This was in 68, when the student revolutions were really going on. And we were aware of it. And we said, Professor Mosser, how on earth do you deal with the student revolution? There's violence, there's mad things going on. And he said, oh no, Steve, no student revolution begins before 2 in the afternoon. I teach at 10. So the moment he said that to me, I said, right, this has got to be a good guy.
Well, he didn't take it all that seriously, unlike some of his colleagues. That's very true, yes.
Well, he encouraged part of it and he did, limited other parts, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He was taken with it. I think he saw the potential, and he thought it was great that young people were mobilized, you know, in shaping their own future.
Right.
I mean, he obviously was not too pleased by the direction it went all the time. But
Very so true. That's when we met in 68. It's a long time ago. Wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, so where are we?
Well, we have your, you know, we've already discussed from the time that you arrived in Israel on.
Oh, we have.
Essentially. That tape I have still. So. So we're at the point when you were engaged with the Habanim, and tell me, how did you say that there were no teachers really that engaged you. So how did your great interest and passion for history emerge? Did that come? I mean, I know you were at the London School of Economics, and how did you end up going into history?
I did my BA in sociology and political science. I did my MA in London in political sociology. So my first two degrees had nothing to do with history. So then you have to look for different routes. Again, you have to come to the youth movement. Why? Because it is there that you had passionate intellectual debates, discussions, and where your mind was liberated, where you were encouraged to think. True, it went along ideological lines. It was a movement, an ideology, but it had intellectual content. I gave, for instance, I was 17, and I was giving kind of seminars on Isaiah Berlin. And I remember the first time I read a serious book is when I was 14. I went to the Zionist Federation and took out Bein's biography of Herzl. This is 14. And at school, it would never have been so. So it was two tracks. One was school, which had absolutely nothing to do with reality. And the other was Habonim, which is where it wasn't history. It was thinking. It was ideas. It was ideals. And until I got to university. And at university, it was liberation. You were opened up to things. And Johannesburg was a reasonable university. But the reading we had, you could read what you want. You could explore. So it was at university that, and the youth movement that I started. And the only reason I became interested in history for me until then was, what were the four reasons for the Industrial Revolution? Why did the French Revolution occur? Number one, number two, and if you get number two as number one, you fail the exam. Dry facts, uninteresting.
It's the way it's still taught too much.
Terrible. It didn't interest me. And yes, here the role of George for history. Was it? I tell you, I was going to do my PhD in sociology on dehumanization. But it was all about abstract, impersonal structures. And then comes George, and I said, well, about culture. And I'm attracted to things cultural. George's critique about German Jews that, you know, they confuse culture with politics, I'm guilty of that to this day. But that's what set me alight. And so, had it not been for George, I don't know what I would have done. I wouldn't. I mean, he did. He molded my career. I went to Madison, Siberia, for George. And yes, that was where my real passion and interest lies until this day. But I didn't know that until I met George.
He had this ability to bring out in people what was already there, but they didn't realize it. You know, that he sparked something.
He definitely sparked, but I mean...
Yeah.
But the first thing he sparked, I'm telling you, was not that. It was his mode, it was his being, much more than his actual work. Mm-hmm. When he walked in, then after that evening about the revolutions, I went to his class on anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And the first class he walks in, he says, looks at the class, says, "Oh, you're all Aryans, all Aryans." So of course you go for that. I mean, then immediately. So it's that got me.
Uh-huh.
It was the human with the erudite thing that coupled for me. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got into history.
Well, we're talking about a recent event we had in Madison where so many of Mossy's undergraduate students from the 60s came back. And this was another case of him just having such an impact on undergraduates. And, you know, who didn't know him that well. And yet they still, 40, 50 years later, are trying to figure out
what it was. And what did they say it was?
Well, you know, it was we're just beginning to explore this, but my understanding is that he had this ability to pull students into a thoughtful way of looking at the world. You know, he just pulled them out of what they had done, a critical way of looking at the world. It was like it woke them up. And in a way, they're going back and trying to figure out the trajectories of their life, where the great influences were, and they're coming back to Mossy, you know.
But then the question is, how does he pull them out? And I think part of it, it's only a part of it, his capacity to personalize.
Yes.
That is, right. He will relate to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't go on, but one of the things, when I was in Israel, as I told you in the second tape, which worked, I taught in these various institutions, the leadership thing and the students thing, and when he met my mother, whom he'd never met, he said, "Hello, Mrs. Asheim, do you know your son is the Goebbels of Israel?"
What a great line.
And so my mother was shocked out of her mind. But you see what I mean?
Yes.
That's the... Suddenly you...
Spark.
You know, it's got nothing... I mean, I really was nothing like the Goebbels of Israel.
Well, he always...
But he gets to...
that. Sorry,
you know,
yes.
So he gets... That's what he... It's a kind of shock... But a humanizing shock, and done with humor, too. I'm sure that a lot of people remember the Mossa stories more than they do the intellectual framework of which he said. I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
But also, I think he took his students seriously. He gave them the compliment of taking them seriously and challenging them. And they remember that, too. So they do remember... that, and also I think there's an ethical and moral aspect to it, that he was able to spark a kind of moral understanding of history and your place in the world and how you have to engage in the world in a moral, ethical, historical way.
Yeah,
I think all of that really, you know, at a time when this whole thing of relevance or whatever, but when people were looking for that, yeah, as they always are.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think he had this ability because he saw history as very much, you know, a life's calling, as a way of understanding the world. I mean, for him, this was, you know, the way of understanding the world, obviously. So,
yeah, no, no question. Yeah,
so I think they understood that. So, well, I don't know that we need to talk much more about your youth, unless you have something more to say, but I want to talk to you about...
Well, first of all, I admire your ability to ask others questions about themselves.
Yeah.
Not, you know, you go to the Hebrew University, and you'll find that virtually every professor is willing to talk endlessly about themselves.
That's not only the Hebrew University,
right,
by the way.
Right.
But, you know, I think your teaching style has some relation, more than some relation to George's style. You have...
It's dual. It's it's double. The first thing is that I was raised in the youth movement, and then you were taught how to keep the interest of kids. It wasn't an obligatory framework, so you had to keep the kids' attention. So the first one is there. And, you know, if you know how to give one of your talks and to motivate the kids, that was all part of the youth movement. And then you add George, right? So. Although, yes, it's modeled partly on George, but I'll never have the guts or the authority that George did. And I'll give you one example. He was teaching at the Hebrew University in the early years. Is it still working? And he was giving a class, I've probably told this in the other interview, on Weimar. And there you had old Weimarians in the class. And one Weimarian stood up and said, "Wait a minute, I was there, it wasn't like that at all." And George would say, "You are in the valley, I'm in the mountain." Now, for instance, I couldn't say something like that. That does take a certain authority. I couldn't do that. So in that sense, George was unique in that sort of thing. So I couldn't do that sort of thing. And there was another thing I wanted to say on this.
Well, it seems like that your attempt to engage...
When have you seen me teach?
Well, in Madison, although you wouldn't let me come to your course too often, but I've heard you lecture. And, you know, you have this ability to reach out to the audience and also to interject humor and, you know, to... pace your teaching, but also to pull them in.
But never had anything like that impact. Just can't compare.
Well, that brings
it's the way
up,
it is.
Yeah, that brings up your career here at the Hebrew University. So when did you get hired here? You was it in the early 80s that you
82.
Came back?
Okay. I came back.
Yeah.
And why did I come back? Because George spoke to Arielli, who spoke to the dean, and there I was. No interview, no lecture, nothing. There I was.
That's the way it was in those days.
That's the way it was. It's not possible today, even with the highest of the high. Yeah. It's just not possible.
So,
82.
Yeah. Some of these people, and we've already discussed the trajectory of your career here on the other tape, but I was wondering, I mean, from your vantage point teaching history and modern Jewish history, German Jewish history, I mean, from the Hebrew University, you've really witnessed an incredible parade of the major intellectuals in this field through Jerusalem. You knew so many of them. You still know so many of them. I mean, you were in a key position.
Wait, just hang on. Before you go on, just let me say, well, it only really just applies to one, but there's something about the camaraderie of George's students which is not that different from the camaraderie of the youth movement.
It's fascinating.
Well, and not only, by the way, you and Andy, there are many others, Seymour, there's, you know, David Sabian.
But I'm not in their circle. Yes. I mean, I'm talking about the nature of the friendship which mm-hmm. was formed as a result. Mm-hmm. That may be true for Cy and
Indeed.
David.
Very much so. Yes, yeah. Very much so. But did you have that sense here at the Hebrew University that you were, you know, a part of a community, that you were in that really at the center of a very important effort to understand German Jewish history, some of the people that you engaged with, that you knew?
Well, first of all, you have to divide into two. I don't think there was, for me, a serious intellectual community working together on that question. All of us were doing it, we were reasonably friendly, but there wasn't a kind of close-knit intellectual community working on these things, although we all did in our own different ways. But the second thing is, there's no doubt that being in Jerusalem, what I wrote or what they wrote has had particular resonance. It may not have the same resonance today. That centrality may be deeply questioned or even over now. That's another question.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean with the decreasing legitimacy and the perception by so many people of the problems here, I'm not so sure that we are seen as an authoritative source anymore. Mm. At least nothing like it used to be. Mm. Also, I think the last major world-famous historians that came out of here would be Talmon in general history and Yaakov Katz in Jewish history. Whereas you could say in America, the most famous Jewish historian worked until a few years ago, and that was Yerushalmi. So, and today I can't think of any historian, Jewish or general, and you know there's this silly cut between Jewish and general history, who has a similar status to the greats. Now the question is, are there any great historians either in Europe or America? That's another question. But I don't think we are as resonant and as relevant as we were 20 years ago. And I don't think that's romanticizing. But I must say something else here, which is ideological. That the longer I've been here, my reading of German history, and this I think George would understand, is very much dictated by the situation here.
I find that to be the case for many Israelis.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you know, there's a problem there, but maybe also something good. I don't know if George... did George see my book in which I wrote about Klemperer? Some people were amazed. You know, I basically attacked Scholem and defended Klemperer, who's an assimilationist. So, you know, where does that come from? That comes from my situation here.
You know, George had a relation, Eva Noack Mawson, and her situation was very similar to that of Klemperer. I mean, she married a Gentile, and she ended up at Theresienstadt.
How was she a relation? She was...
She was the daughter of one of George's grandfather's brothers. I believe daughter or granddaughter. And anyways, I'm having translated this memoir. You could read it in German. I can send it to you in German. But it's amazing the similarities between her experiences and Klemperer. And also the way she writes, it's nothing about her, in a sense. It's not about making you feel empathy for her or feeling sorry for herself or look what they did. It's just very factual, high level of rational analysis of what happened to her, because she, and I think she felt that she was writing for, as a warning, as a caution.
Where did you get the memoir? Did George have it, or you got it subsequently?
I got it at the Leo Beck Institute.
Oh.
They told me about it.
Oh.
And actually, she corresponded with George.
Mm.
I think there's something like 10 letters, so I'm going to have those translated, too. But no, you didn't write about Klemperer during George's lifetime, but that book had just come out, I believe, and your book on Klemperer.
He knew about it.
It came out
in 2001.
Okay. That book came out in 2001?
I think, yeah.
Okay. Because I know think. I recall that he knew about the book. Maybe there was two volumes.
Yeah. And maybe Charles Friedlander. I asked Charles what he thinks. He said it's not complete. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say a word more. I said, well, give me a criticism.
No.
Not complete.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. George and Shaul, mm-hmm. although Shaul is younger than George, born in 36,
right,
can't take a step that a lot of people who are younger can take because of their respect, and correctly so, for the achievement of creating a state at a time when it was crucial, but we're not prepared to say, wait a minute, there's some very, very basic things here which you have to face. Walter LaCour is another.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think George understood this contradiction. He had this, you know, romantic idea of nationalism with the human face, that in Israel is where it was most profoundly manifested.
Correct.
But quickly, you know, but he, hope springs eternal. But I think for him it was a very personal reason, and that is, you know, fundamentally he was wounded by his own history, in that sense of insecurity deeply, and I think that he really did feel great attachment to Israel, and also to the, in particular to the people, you know, to that group that he knew. For George, Israel was a group of intellectuals, essentially, and their families, and he didn't have much interaction with the rest of Israeli society, from what I can tell. I mean, anyways, he didn't learn Hebrew
That's the story of that I repeat everywhere, right? You know, I mean, Adonai, waiter, Adonai. I get wonderful service.
But
I think, by the way, when you say his insecurity, I argued with Friedlander, and maybe I'm wrong. And said George didn't act as a survivor, and Shaul says, no, he was deeply wounded and therefore insecure as a survivor. I said, no, I may be wrong. But I think another part of my attraction to him was that his insecurity accounts for his humanity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that's
he knew that.
You know, okay, well, fine. I mean, that's what...
Yeah. Because, you know, when you think of what a powerful personality George was, and he always said that, you know, exile made him, because you could imagine him as a very, you know, arrogant, nasty person. I mean, he could have been if he had had a very secure, you know, grown up as the son of a very wealthy man, and you know, I think that part of his personality might have been more manifested, but when you see what happened to him and his sister, they both became these great humanitarians, and, you know, this universalist vision, they lived that their whole lives. So, you know, but I think that was because of the experiences that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, he understood that about himself, I think. I think he was deeply wounded. I think that it did make him very insecure, but he had a lot of courage, I would say. He kind of was able to overcome that and present himself in a certain way that was very different from that. You know, I think
his bodily movements gave him away.
That's right, yes.
But that also was attractive to me.
It was
human.
It was very, he was very human, yes, he was. Very good way, yes. But
So we've done our bit for the,
I think
for the Mossa.
Yes, but I am going to say I would like to interview again at some point to talk a bit more about your work.
I'll be dead by then.
Well, who knows? I will be back, and it'll give me a good reason.
So turn off and tell me. You've me.